said you can kill my body, but you know you can't mess with my mind.
Welcome to Economics and Beyond. I'm Rob Johnson, president of the Institute for New Economic Thinking.
Say you can kill my body.
Say you can kill my body.
But you know you can't mess with my mind.
Say, no, you can't kill my mind.
You know we'll go away.
We're gonna go away.
Come back, come back, come back,
come back.
My second time.
I'm here today with my research director, Thomas Ferguson, Philip Elvelda, and John Mallory. Philip is the CEO and chairman of BrainWorks Foundry, a developer of artificial intelligence-enhanced healthcare technologies and services. Previously, Dr. Elvelda was a program manager at the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, so-called DARPA, Biological Technologies Office. John Mallory is the Chief Technical Officer at WFA Group, LLC. And for the last 40 years, he's been involved as a researcher at the MIT Artificial Intelligence Laboratory and its successor, the Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Laboratory. He's also a fellow at the Oxford Martin School, or an associate and a senior fellow at the Security and Defense Research Center of the Conservatoire National des Arts et Métiers in Paris. Thank you guys for joining me. The urgency of what you're working on and what is featured on the front page of iNet's website right now involves, finally, I have to say, the relationship between health precaution and the economy. People acted as if there was a trade-off. And this really extraordinary piece that you gentlemen have put together brings us to the place where we can see that health precaution is not a substitute. If you're a budget hawk, there is no question that you ought to be advocating a whole myriad of health precautions that will save us the public treasure in the medium and longer term. Let me start with you, Phil. What have you seen? What are your graphics and charts tell people that we can guide them towards? And what kind of things do we need to put in place to get this pandemic under control and behind us and save some of our fiscal capacity for important things like climate change in the future?
Rob, thanks for the kind intro. Really pleasure to be here. I think the key realization of our work since last January, really, when we saw the pandemic coming upon us from early reports from Asia, was really to try and sort out, you know, what were the real root causes, where was the economic damage coming from, and how could we, you know, both save lives and do it in the most cost-effective way possible that would preserve our ability to do other things, just as you described. And I would say that for months, there was a lot of confusion. You know, we didn't really have the data gathering capabilities. We weren't even really sure, you know, what the transmission modes of the virus were. And so, you know, we were fortunate enough, John, myself, and Thomas, to be connected to a group of internationally distributed scientists, technologists, epidemiologists, and economists. Where we began to collect data internationally and look at it to figure out what's really happening. And not just what's happening with the virus, but, you know, what measures are different nations and even states within the nations and even cities within the states, what are they doing that is either effective or not? And it required a lot of sophisticated data fiddling to really kind of tease out some of these effects that are not obvious. You know, the first 100 times you look at the data. And so really, it was a marathon effort over several months to be able to pull all these bits together, sort through all of the noise, and really determine definitively that there really is no trade-off between the economy and how you treat the virus. You know, as we say in the paper, the economic success begins and ends with solving the pandemic itself. So the question then becomes, you know, how do you do that effectively? And so then, we address that and recommend some measures. But that's really how we started the process, and that was the goal. And then, the recommendations that we offer kind of followed from, experiments kind of teasing apart the different variables and working with the different groups in different countries that were either seeing success or not.
So, Tom, when you look at the mistakes that were made at the key junctures, it seemed to me as though people were acting as though they were afraid of the economy's downturn, so they had to stop protecting health so that people could get back to work, start consuming, et cetera, et cetera. And instead, what they created is this series of waves where the depth and the duration is going to exhaust our physical capacity when we could have had this behind us right now.
Well, yes. I mean, this goes a bit beyond the details in our paper, but it was obvious from the very beginning there was a large block of folks cross-nationally. I mean, one of the strengths of the paper, I think, is exactly as Philip indicated, is its cross-national frame of reference. So we really did look at these very large number of countries. But there was across them all, somebody usually very loudly stood up for some notion of herd immunity, that poorly understood, as John kept reminding all of us. And there was a lot of noise when you sifted it. Yeah, the economy was certainly a principal concern of a lot of folks. I mean, that was true in Germany. It was true in Sweden. You had folks in the European Business Roundtable getting up and saying, you really can't afford to lock down. You had that echoed by the guy on the German Economic Council. There were large numbers of folks in the U.S. President Trump had his kitchen cabinet. There were private equity folks there very loudly speaking out against shutting down the economy. Across the Western economies, that was generally true. And what they got instead, as Philip said, straight, but it could just put it in slightly different words. You get this disastrous stop-go pattern where you sort of act half-heartedly to contain it. Then you let it go at the first opportunity, and then it comes back on you in bigger amplitude. But the places where that didn't happen are a string of countries in Asia where people are used to having a sort of effective state bureaucracy. And I would note, maybe it's not something we got into in the report, this was by no means a story of authoritarianism. Most of the countries that tamed this in Asia are functioning democracies by any standard, ranging from Taiwan to New Zealand to Japan, wherever. Or even Australia. Now, the Australians and the New Zealanders, this again is a bit beyond what we actually dealt with in there, they clearly stopped very quickly and shut down and really did. To this day, it's hard for people to get in and out of Australia without a lot of checks. Similarly true in New Zealand. And some European countries, especially Germany, and some of the Nordics, not Sweden, where the health minister, but also some of the industrialists, quite openly championed herd immunity or something close to that. Sometimes something else by the same name. They, outside of Sweden, the Nordics did pretty well too. But nobody has done well except the Asians, speaking in the sense of including New Zealand and Australia, against the later waves. Though again, as our diagram showed you, Germany and the Nordics still do better, but they're hit pretty hard too.
Well, John Mallory, what did you see? You were talking in some of the sessions that I've observed about the virus being airborne. You had a wonderful speaker from San Diego present to us. And I know in your paper together, in addition to talking about lockdowns and getting ahead of the curve, you create a what I'll call something like a 1,000-to-1 impact from providing KN95 masks to everybody mailed to their house relative to what we did with our fiscal bailouts in the early on. But John, how are you putting this all together?
Well, let me just pick up on Tom first and then come back to the airborne question. So if we look at it from the lens of an engineer and a computer scientist, the problem that you need to work is how do I prevent any human transmission for 2 weeks? And in 2 weeks, you've burned the virus out and you're done. Your whole population's clean. So the paradigm example is really what the Communist Party in China was able to do once it mobilized in Wuhan. So no physical travel, everybody locked down, they had to stay in their apartments, everything, the food and so forth, they had to get it online. They would order it from the market or the pharmacy. They would package it up, deliver it to the neighborhood, and the local party cadres would then take it to your apartment. If somebody tested positive, they were hauled off into a quarantine facility, and that's what they did, and they managed to step on it. And other countries have done lesser approximations of that. And we can say that it's a political choice when you do lesser approximations. So you may believe in freedom and whatever you believe in, and then you do this calculus and you relax it. So we saw in the United States really kind of a loose lockdown that never really got as far, say, as the Chinese. And that's sort of just a point of comparison. So the political dimension is really key in how you're able to respond with non-pharmaceutical interventions, as we call everything other than therapies in the hospitals or vaccines to prevent it. Those also have their own political dimensions. As for the airborne question, I was tracking this virus from January 10th because I saw it happening in China and I follow China pretty closely. So I started writing code to see what exponents really meant and what kind of, functions would be applied. And in the process, talked to some of my Chinese colleagues who told me the story of somebody on the bus 10 meters away from the infected person with an N95 mask on, but the mask was not tightly fitting and they were infected. So that was sort of airborne from China in February. And then I think the Europeans were pretty quick to figure out that it was airborne, did some work with, promoting masks. In the US, there was delay. The CDC didn't figure out it was airborne for a long time. Then finally, Kim Prather, who is has a center, NSF-funded center at UC San Diego, studying airborne viruses and bacteria, and they have sort of great engineering technology for studying these. She and her colleagues were able to show by May 20th that it was airborne. But meanwhile, there was a debate in the scientific community of, well, what does airborne mean? How far does it go? And a lot of, sort of academic discussion about whether they were going to sign on, whether they believe the results and so forth. And then some studies also replicated it. So by probably mid-August or so, she finally briefed Fauci on the results that they had. And then a couple of months later, the CDC has come to see airborne transmission as a problem and therefore doubled down on the issue of wearing masks. So in the U.S., we had a big delay on that. And the mask is one of the more powerful things you can do if you're not prepared to impose, isolation of individuals and strong quarantine measures. That's kind of how we got there. And then I guess, one could, look at the response questions of, why did we get there? And it seems that after the Ebola response, there was, you know, work by the Defense Department in the U.S., and a structure was set up on the National Security Council for pandemic response with lessons learned from that, which was in place when the Trump administration came in. And I guess it stayed there for a while. And then under Bolton, they decided it wasn't needed and they dismantled it, you know, probably a year, 18 months before this pandemic hit. So that probably impaired our response to some degree because we didn't have as tight a connection with the various agencies and an orchestration of the response.
Yeah, could I add a point on that?
Sure.
That type of we have something in place and then dismantle it happened in country after country. It happened in the British National Health Service. It happened even in Holland, the Netherlands. It happened in many parts of Southern Europe. The urge to save money thanks to austerity pressures was very large. In the U.S., there was a huge amount of change in hospital situations whereby folks were in effect moving toward a kind of just-in-time health service where they would get rid of as much spare capacity as possible. So there's no doubt at all. There's some excellent research on this. Eileen Applebaum and Rosemary Batman had a paper for INET on that and the role of, say, private equity purchases of hospitals and tending to just get rid of anything that didn't look like an immediate profitable thing. Everybody in the West was hitting heavily back. It's no secret that in the Asian developmental states did not do that type of austerity. That point's been made a million times. And the Australians famously didn't sign on to all of that. And of course, neither did the New Zealanders, though they bounced back and forth there. I mean, that's quite a general phenomenon that over the last decade or more, stuff that looked sensible and that would have helped was getting dismantled.
Let me build on that for a second.
Let me build on it.
I got an immediate, you know, issue on this. So in organization theory, they look at organizational resilience and they have the concept of extra knowledge and extra capacity. And you keep that around in order to be able to respond to events. Recently, Professor Moshe Vardy gave a distinguished lecture for the National Science Foundation on the trade-off between efficiency and resilience. And it's a very interesting lecture. It cuts across multiple fields, focuses heavily on economics, on how we focus on efficiency rather than resilience. And we have a hard time pricing how much resilience we need. But he also takes it into computer science and algorithms. And so, I mean, we can look at it as an economic problem that we fail to price the need for resilience into a pandemic response. And in addition, it turned out that as we were doing globalization, much of the pharmaceutical and medical products were outsourced to other countries to save small amounts of money. And then, of course, And it turned out that somebody actually, I forget the name at the moment, but they took a look at this and by December of 2019 had a whole list of these dependencies where the United States had lost the capacity to produce these kinds of supplies. And then, of course, along comes the pandemic when you need it, and then you have difficulty getting the supplies of medical and pharmaceutical products that you need. And you also saw in the European Union where there was a hoarding of these products, even in that environment. Over to you, Phil.
I think the offshoring is a
key point, and highlighting the weakness of the outsourced value chain for low cost international production turned out to be catastrophic in the case where everyone in the world needed the supply chain all at once. Most notably, the country that was doing the supply. And once the pandemic began roaring, from China, they, of course, rapidly expanded their production of masks. They shipped masks all across the country in China, and it became harder and harder and harder to find masks in Europe and most of the West. which, you know, put us in a really interesting position where we could not have the tools at hand to prevent that initial surge. And the way to think of it is, and one of the key points of our paper is that, you know, exponential math is really unforgiving. You know, at the very beginning, it doesn't really look that bad because it's not clear that it's exponential. And so you have this period of, you know, yeah, it's happening, but it doesn't seem that bad. And then all of a sudden, you kind of hit the knee in the curve and the exponential really starts to take over. And anything that you might do that's additive, like adding another plant, just is already behind the exponential curve. And so then of course, you've got a tragedy and your only recourse is a lockdown. But the key point is that in that smooth kind of early phase of exponential growth, where it's still gentle, you know, milder actions and abatement measures can stop the virus as long as it's early. And the key that we suffered was without the masks, we didn't have the tool that would be the mild early approach that could have prevented large growth. And then when we were done, delaying, that first surge in New York and Washington and California, we were already past the knee of the exponential curve. And the only recourse was shutdown and go through that period of difficulty to abate the virus. But that's the point. So the longer you wait and the longer the exponential has to take hold, the greater your measure has to be. And so, you know, the one of the cardinal rules that we're proposing and why we're driving the need for quick action and is that quick action can use mild tools like masks and distancing. If you don't do those and you're still on the exponential growth curve, it's a road to disaster that is inevitable. No proclamations of freedom or, liberty or anything will stave off the virus when it hits that exponential growth phase that exceeds your early capacity. And then lockdown and economic ruin.
So I just take it back to to contact tracing, to run the loop to track down who's been infected and then to, take appropriate public health measures. And why didn't we do that? Well, we didn't want to spend the money, right? So there's an interesting paper by David Cutler and Lawrence Summers on pricing the COVID pandemic, and they estimate it to be a $16 trillion hit. And when you understand that the numbers are that big, so that's a full, annual GNP for the U.S., then it might be worth spending $100 billion to be able to do, say, contact tracing, or it might be worth spending $100 billion to be able to have an infrastructure in place so you'd be ready to respond. You'd exercise that infrastructure. It'd been practiced up and down from federal to local government, and then you'd be ready to handle it. So I think I take the problem actually back to economics, that we didn't have the conceptual apparatus in many of our economic theories to really handle the issue of resilience. And we saw it come up with the tsunami and earthquake in Japan on supply chains. And now we've seen it again in pandemic. We certainly have that problem when it applies to the cyber resilience question. So I would say it's a challenge for international trade theorists of, do we need some modifications to international trade if efficiency is not the only goal? If there's resilience as part of the picture, then what does that mean? Similarly, in terms of domestic economic policy, how do we price the amount of resilience that we need for various contingencies? So I think these are important challenges for the economics field, and we'd like to see some research to work those questions out.
Yeah, well, INET does a lot on the social costs of various activities. And in general, I think the economics of this are pretty straightforward. The private price system doesn't catch the social costs and benefits. And what you usually need for that is some form of intervention to get them closer to each other. Otherwise, you just go on in a system sort of without a head or a headless horseman, if you like. I would add that the lesson from this, exactly as both of my colleagues just stressed, is that, you know, it's much easier to give people masks and do some sensible social distancing and do some measures to offset instead of pouring like hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars into all kinds of things and grand economic aid. I mean, and if you'd actually like pay people as we recommend to just sit out, not to work while they're sick, and to make sure that they can afford testing, you'll do much better with that form of intervention than you will with vast subsidies, either fiscal or monetary.
And at this point, what is the role of what you might call quality data? If you talk about, as things are raging, do we need to lock down the whole country, or can we be discriminating to what you might call extinguish it by understanding what's happening by zip code or county or state or what have you?
Yeah, Rob, that's a key point of the paper, is that, you know, we see the extreme general blank, you know, call it a blanket lockdown, as kind of the result of policy failure or, you know, inaction earlier when milder measures could have carried the day. And I think that, you know, we would all agree that in that first lockdown nationally, you know, we didn't really understand how the disease spread, and we could see it just crushing, you know, boroughs in New York. And even within New York State, you know, there were regions that, you know, hadn't even heard of the virus or even realized it was an issue. So, and they, of course, suffered economic damage completely needlessly when there was zero prevalence in their area. And so I think that, you know, one of the big advances that we have achieved over the last months is that, you know, there is now dozens of groups with pretty good data infrastructure that is tracking the disease being reported out of every hospital, all of the states, most of the counties, and a good number of the zip codes even, where we have a pretty good understanding of where the outbreaks are happening and where there should be concern. And we absolutely have the ability with those tools to focus, you know, where abatement measures are concentrated. But I want to highlight that one of the key abatement measures that makes a regional response possible is that you have to be able to isolate the periods, the regions or the locales of high prevalence, so that a local outbreak doesn't become a state outbreak and a state outbreak doesn't become a national one. And so that, you know, that divide and conquer strategy is really important to be able to manage the cost and direct, you know, not just abatement measures, but financial support into those specific zones that allows you to suppress things. And, you know, Tom talked about the social cost. There's some subtleties to that that are really important. You know, you think about, okay, we have essential services. You know, we have Amazon delivery. We've got the supermarket workers. We've got the healthcare workers. All of them have to keep working. But, you know, at this point, we don't have the testing and tracing capacity to be able to make sure that those people that we are, you know, instructing to keep working and sustaining the rest of us that that can manage to be paid or to stay at home. We have to be sure that they are not carrying the disease as super spreaders themselves. And so there's a critical piece even in operating this divide and conquer approach, which, by the way, you know, we can take it not just down to the zip code level. China was taking this approach down to the city block level, where they would lock down the apartments where there was an outbreak and, you know, really put a cordon around it and make sure that they had all the food that they need and the pharmaceuticals and the medicines that they need while they sat there for 2 weeks until the virus burned out within the apartment block and then opened it back up. And the economy, you know, in the rest of the city just proceeded unabated. So that is the type of approach that's possible that can get us through this thing with which much less cost and much less pain and much less death.
So I would just add to what Phil said, that in the after the Chinese sort of cleaned up Wuhan, they've had some outbreaks, you know, for example, in Beijing. And they have a procedure where if they see, you know, 15 to 20 cases, then they pounce on it right away. They do the lockdown. They test everybody right away. And then they sort it out from there. It's been effective. And I note that that New York City's actually been fighting it block by block as well. And so that's a much mm-hmm. better, you know, granularity to fight it by than to be fighting it by states or the whole country lockdowns. So that's where we'd like to get. But once you you let it go in an uncontrolled fashion, which it sounds like we have at least 20 states with uncontrolled, you know, epidemics at this point, it becomes so widespread that the contact tracing capability can't keep up with it. And they just throw their hands up. And then you're forced back to a lockdown to get it down to a reasonable level. And you're also forced to the lockdown because your hospitals are overflowing. And when you can't admit the patients, then the death rate goes up to, you know, in a big way. I mean, the last report on the Chinese, 20% of the people infected would go to the hospital. They'd have a serious illness, and one third of those would die. And so the estimate is that maybe half would die if you overflowed the hospital.
Tom, let me ask a question about American politics now. We have an election where it appears that Joe Biden has won, but this is all being contested. You have a lame duck administration, and you have people like the gentleman that we're online with right now who have a vision of how to get this under control. What does all of the turbulence in governance mean for our ability to execute on behalf of the public and get this under control?
Well, when we didn't have the political turbulence we have now, we were already making a mess of it. And that's clear, right? You could say, well, the elections was in full force in February, okay, but not like it is now. Even as we're talking, I see that I just got a little note that pops up on my screen from email saying the Treasury Secretary said he doesn't want to continue several pandemic programs. I have to look into the details of that. My sense is that we're sitting on a mess, though I would urge, sir, this goes a bit beyond our own actual report, which stays pretty close to facts and is sort of a clinical assessment of how we got here. But my read of where we're at right now is I was a little taken aback at some of the Biden transition documents on COVID in particular. My sense is that they have been trying to make up their minds about how much they want to use things like OSHA, you know, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration Agency, and they're going to have to use the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency. They've got really effective authority that sits in there all by existing statute. And what I'm not seeing right now is any sort of interagency coordination, right? They put a load of very able doctors, mostly on the transition for COVID, but this is also partly an interagency program, and I can't tell you exactly where they're at there, but they're going to have to do a much broader thing than I have seen anybody talking about. I mean, the thing in our report is there's a heavy stress on using tools that are easy, cheap, and exist now in a form, I hope my colleagues would probably agree with me, a kind of high-tech application of an intelligent lockdown and targeted lockdowns, not full lockdowns. And they need to get on that and to do that. And boy, when you contemplate how you get the resistances, Philip
routinely would call attention to the way some states were data was kind of weird over the last few months. I mean, the state authorities, we hope, are getting used to actually reporting, but, you know, even the excess deaths data, to my knowledge, are not really well put together at the moment. They're going to need a big data effort, and they haven't got a lot of time to do this.
So, one of the things that seem to be missing in the Biden group is an economist. I think they need to understand the economics of this. If you, particularly after you read the Larry Summers and Color piece, you see there's interesting ways to measure the costs, and then you can evaluate how much you should spend, what the cost benefit is at that level. And the other thing is a strategic communications effort, because one of the big problems we have at this point, given how the situation has been politicized, is individual behaviors. So we need to persuade people to do the right thing, especially as this pandemic peaks during the winter and before we can get the vaccines distributed. And in terms of the individual behavior, we had a recent speaker in our seminar who was an expert on social media and disinformation, tracks the campaigns. And she had data showing that there was two orders of magnitude more disinformation on the U.S. Social media in this period since February than obtained in the 2016 and 2018 election cycles. And what that means is there's both domestic and foreign adversaries who are busy putting out disinformation that undermines the pandemic response. Now, for the United States, China is basically back on its feet. It's going to grow, you know, pretty well, modulo, whatever limitations there are on international trade in the next year. And we're going to get hit again. So when our economy doesn't, you know, perform as well as the competitors, then we're at a disadvantage. And so are our friends and allies. So we now see a situation in which you can use influence operations to have a strategic impact on other countries. And under international law, there's really no barrier to that. But one maybe could find a prohibition by looking at some of the bioweapons conventions and see if there's any kind of prohibition on to piling onto ongoing pandemics. So that's a further problem that's going to confront the Biden response. And so another recommendation would be to mobilize some of the people that study the disinformation campaigns and the ways to counter them, which they often actually compare to a sort of a cult-like adherence. And so it's really a deprogramming problem, but to basically fund some high-speed research there that can turn into some policy that could be done to help improve the behavioral responses to get over this pandemic.
Phil, what's going on in mask production now? Did we refute it and then get back on the horse, or are we still refusing to produce the masks that you think could play a big role?
You know, I do think that domestic production has stepped up somewhat in the United States. The better news is that the, you know, industrial capacity in China, once they conquered the virus domestically, their need for additional domestic distribution of masks dropped off dramatically. And so they are exporting again. And really, they are kind of the, I would say, the heart of much of the production. Europe also has substantially increased their mask production. So as far as mask availability, in theory, they're available here in the U.S. But I still think we have lingering distribution challenges. And there are right now where the hospitals are surging. And as John said, you know, with kind of a diversified private privately funded healthcare system, they were all doing the same kind of surge capacity versus, you know, inventory, you know, sunk inventory cost calculations. And none of the Midwestern states really have either the hospital capacity in terms of beds or, you know, the stores of masks readily available to them. And, yeah, and they don't necessarily all have the budgets to be able to purchase them individually. So I do think that we still have a supply chain problem that starts with, you know, who's funding it? Is there enough money to fund it? And then kind of rapidly goes into, all right, where do we get them? The where do we get them and how quickly can we get them problem? Solvable, but we're still struggling with the who pays for it problem.
Yeah. Could I underscore that? Just, I took the precaution of talking to a lot of people in touch with hospitals over the last few months. And what I find over and over, scary cases where when the first wave of the virus passed, nobody did much to restock. One is reading about cases where they're having to reuse gowns or masks and things. And of course, the burnout of the healthcare personnel is also a problem. But Philip is really right when he sort of lays on the problem distribution rather than the mere absence of the thing. Although, you know, it's still the case that when you try to go buy a mask, you're confronted with a bewildering number of things that claim to be okay, many of which sometimes turn out not to be okay, and that we still don't have what we should have, which is a mass scale, large scale distribution of free masks to whoever needed them as quickly as possible.
Right. And I would say go farther than that. Don't even wait for the people to decide whether they need it or not. You know, here's an interesting stat that I noticed just walking around here in the San Francisco Bay Area a couple weeks ago. And keep in mind, this was before, you know, the recent resurgence. So this was kind of in the, I call it the late summer when we seemed to have things over control, under somewhat of control. The schools and the bars were opening up again, even though, you know, a few areas still had some good prevalence. And I took the liberty of strolling around outside in a couple of the different areas of San Francisco, you know, in the Bay Area. Walnut Creek, for example, one of the East Bay communities, I'd say probably about 80% mask compliance, but the mask quality was very poor. People just had, you know, gaiters and, you know, simple cloth masks that you know, really are less than half as effective as a good quality N95 or KN95 mask. But then you wander over into Oakland's Chinatown, 99% plus mask compliance, everyone wearing a high quality KN95 mask. So those people that were aware of it and connected to, you know, socially connected to this Chinese supply chain were highly compliant and they were able to source high quality masks. But for whatever social reasons, political reasons you want to point to, I think there's a vast community in the United States not equipping themselves to the best benefit.
Just like to build on that. I mean, you know, the second class mass, I think, is a, you know, a huge problem. And we should flood the market with N95s or N100s. There's just no question about that. And that will incentivize people to wear it more because it actually will protect them if they can wear it correctly. Now, the problem with those masks is wearing it correctly. You have to have no leaks on the sides to be safe in the presence of this virus when it's airborne. And that's hard to do. And I'll tell you, I've been wearing a N100 mask, which I bought in January before they outlawed individuals buying them. And it causes, you know, sort of pain in your face to wear these things. And so therefore, you know, a high-speed R&D program, one of the DARPA sort of high-speed, you know, activities would be great if they could work on some new mask technology that was easier to use, more comfortable. And then I guess we can let the civilians do the style modifications to make them nice looking. We've seen a lot of nice looking masks being cranked out, but it'd be good to be able to get them up to the protection levels of those N95s. The other thing I think would be helpful is the labeling of these masks. So if you bought something, You knew what the level of protection was you were actually buying. I think that's very important too.
Yeah, could I add a point?
Please.
I actually had time to read what the Treasury Secretary just said, and he does not want to renew the municipal lending facility, among other facilities, and also the Main Street facility there. Now, we make the point in our report that you have got to deal with the transportation problem, especially in big cities, because you can't be sending people who have to go, you know, they need the mass transit to work. It's not possible, whatever some private companies might want, that everybody can just go every day take, Uber or Lyft or something. It just can't happen in a place like Manhattan or, many other large cities. And you need the mass transit system to be functional, but you also need it to be safe. And I think John was the one who made the point early on, you need lots of air circulation systems revivified, to make almost a pun, and you need considerable filtering. Buildings need it too. You have got to do something about this. Otherwise, you're just going to be spreading the virus around on a colossal scale in large cities. This is just nuts. The mass transit authorities everywhere are in trouble. They had gotten some money in some cases, but the revenues they live from are way down, and the states that support them, their revenues are way down. I mean, you're looking here at a real disaster if somebody doesn't do something.
So let me just add to that. I mean, if we look at most of the airliners today have HEPA filters, and they will take viruses out down to the 1 micron size. And a typical airplane will turn over the air every 2 to 3 minutes. So you're actually in pretty good shape in an airliner that has HEPA filters, whereas in the airport, it's another story. Well, this HEPA filter technology can be put into air filtration systems, and that's recommended. Kim Prather says that as long as you're turning the air over in something like 7 to 8 minutes, that you're going to do pretty well. CDC has talked about 15 minutes of exposure in a room. So you could try to modify the air filtration systems on buses and subways and so forth and in buildings. Alternatively, if that's not so feasible, then the availability of portable air filtration units that you put in a room or some number of them in a room in order to achieve the desired effect. So I think this is another high leverage direction in addition to the masks.
And vital for schools.
Sure, for schools. Anywhere you've got to put people in the same room, frankly. Ski areas.
A lot of the mountains in North America are closing down for the winter, is my understanding.
They were opening, and last year I have some friends in Colorado that reported that, it ran right through the ski resorts. And the Germans, their wave came back from the holiday vacations in the Italian Austrian Alps.
Yeah, Tyrol.
They got across from Italy there, and then they all came home and spread it around.
And we here we are coming up on the holiday season, American Thanksgiving, and then the Christmas holiday. What are you? What would you recommend to the people?
I think people need to get on lockdown again because this is a bigger surge than the spring surge, and mm-hmm. And all they got to do is make it through a few months, and pretty soon we'll start getting distribution of these new vaccines. And then we ought to be able to move past this this problem probably in the course of the year. Fauci was expecting wide availability of vaccines by April. So we're just looking at a tough winter. And if you get through that, then things are going to get better.
And are you seeing, it's hard for me to know without a strong biological understanding, am I seeing marketing or am I seeing progress in the development of vaccines?
Probably a little bit of both.
I'm sure of that.
I do think, for example, the early reports of, 90% efficacy and so on, you know, this is very early in the collection process. And so, you know, efficacy, yeah, in the first 7 days. But, you know, how long lasting is it? Does it have any side effects? You know, these are questions that haven't even been, you know, tested yet to many cases. So there's still, you know, quite a lot of work for the FDA and other statisticians to do, looking over the data that they've supplied to even, you know, give ourselves confidence that, yeah, it might work for some people or not others, or, you know, it'll work for a limited amount of time, or it might have some side effects that you want to avoid. We just don't know. So there is risk associated with it, but I'll tell you that the technology to produce these things is astounding. And, you know, here I would credit some colleagues from the DARPA days at the Biological Technologies Office. A lot of people don't know where some of this technology comes from. It came from, you know, two people, Dan Wattendorf and Matt Hepburn at DARPA, who realized that it took too damn long to produce a vaccine for a virus. And if there was a pandemic, we didn't have the time. And so going back, you know, 4 or 5 years, they decided to invest in the pandemic detection systems, pandemic modeling systems. And in fact, they invested in a couple young postdocs from MIT to create a new company called Moderna. And within a year of that initial DARPA investment and their development of the rapid vaccine production technologies, they were acquired, you know, by Sanofi for, you know, $400 million. And that's why we have a quick Moderna vaccine in the United States that would not have been possible but for the foresight of those people. So that, I think that's a very important credit that, that people should understand, you know, the value of DARPA, the value of advanced scientific imaginings, and kind of understanding what it means when, you know, over the course of the last 4 or 5 years, we've had, you know, 4 or 5 major diseases evolve. And we've been lucky. You know, Ebola, super, super lethal, but so lethal that it kind of killed its host before they transmitted much. You know, now we've got coronavirus, not tremendously lethal, but very, very communicable to the point where it overwhelms health systems. And that, of course, you know, ramps up the lethality kind of intrinsically and kind of the failed system response. But now, you know, think in the next couple of years where we're going to see the next couple of pandemics, it's not out of the question that we'll check both boxes at the same time, communicable and lethal. And that could be, you know, even worse. And so I think that this is a little bit of a wake-up call that even as bad as it is, it's not as bad as it could actually get. And so we really need to come around on the pandemic preparedness and really think about the economics of that from the get-go, just of forestalling horrific costs in the event that, you know, we roll snake eyes in a couple of years. Mm.
So, yeah, I back Phil's points. Kudos to DARPA for that vision. And it's great that, you know, we're seeing good results on the vaccines, but the foundation remains the non-pharmaceutical interventions, so masks, social distancing, and so forth as a baseline, and then you bring that in on top, because there may be some variation in how well the vaccines work, how rapidly you can deploy them, and so forth, so you're going to need that that baseline. I think it's also worth noting that the cyber espionage in the vaccine area is going full blast. And I think there's, at last count, about 14 different vaccine development efforts. And many states are busy spying on the other guy to figure out what he's doing. I think outside the U.S., with the exception of the German and Pfizer effort, most of them are not using messenger RNA. They're generating vaccines from dead virus. So there's a lot of interest in finding out what the other guys are doing, checking their clinical trials. But if you're in their computers, you could tamper with the integrity of their data. And that could cause a whole set of problems. So this nation state strategic competition at the pandemic level over who's going to have the vaccines is a background problem that we're also dealing with in this situation. And we've actually had conversations with the Russians and the Chinese and said not to do the disinformation, that everyone would take a very dim view of that and there'd be consequences, and not to do the tampering with the or espionage on the vaccine producers and tampering with it. There's something to be said if you want to calm that down, and also to help the developing countries to pooling resources across some of the major pharma powers, if you will, in order to come up with the appropriate kinds of vaccines and distribution systems in order to get these out to the developing world, because many of those countries are having trade consequences from the pandemic. There's substantial efforts to provide debt relief, but the debt relief will not suffice if the disruption lasts too long. They need to get the international trade going again in the international economy. And so the effort to really fight the pandemic globally is important for everybody, and to get the world economy going and get everyone else's economies back on their feet.
Well, before I ask you for last questions or observations that you'd like to share, I wanted to ask about what's happening in India, because there I see a very large society with not a lot at an earlier stage of development. And I keep hearing reports from board members, people who work with us, that things are really raging out of control. Is there a particular perspective on how India could handle things that you would like to impart?
So I think the Indians have quite a bit of capability on their own. They have domestic pharmaceutical capacity, and I think they've been working the problem. So I don't know what additional supplies and inputs they might need, but I think it'd be important to provide them. It's a big country. It's the largest democracy in the world, and they definitely have challenges. They did their lockdowns, but they had behavioral issues that people walked home, even though there was no transportation for them to get there. And I guess it's raging in New Delhi now, because it's their sort of winter season, and I guess there's more indoor activity.
Yeah, I think I would add that, you know, the scourge of the developing countries, and really even the scourge in the United States, I think mirrors this, is that you have a class of people that have no means to separate themselves, whether they're forced to use public transportation on the way to work, or they're living in a, you know, tiny multi-generational household, that means that anyone that has the disease, you know, the likelihood of spreading it and the number of people they spread it to is very, very high. And so all of the developing countries that have had success in managing the virus have really focused a large part of their pandemic response in working, like in the case of Brazil with the favelas, with India in the case of the slums that are so famous, to give them all the aid of, you know, mask availability and quarantine quarters, so that when people are ill, that they can, you know, kind of abate the spread. But we see it again and again, where the low-income areas are the places that sustain and reseed the virus in other places that are otherwise cleansed to some other measure. So I think that, if you want to talk about a critical infrastructure need for future pandemics, we got to figure out how to provide more and better housing and healthcare in advance in these poor communities. And this isn't just a matter of charity. It's a matter of enlightened self-interest, where it's going to cost everyone else around them way more to deal with the pandemic that they sustain than it would have been to just treat those people a little bit better.
So I want to bring that point back to resilience. So in these situations where you have low-income people, what is that? That's they have limited or no local resilience. And so by subsidizing them so they can stay home when they're sick, you're able to give them that resilience, and then they can not infect other people by going to work anyway.
Yeah, the I'm always brought back to the very simple poem that is in the Guinness Book of World Records as the shortest poem in the history of the world. It's by Muhammad Ali. And he was getting off the stage at Harvard University, and somebody said, "What about a poem, Ali?" And he looked out at the audience and he said, "Me, we." Well, I think there's a whole lot that's wrong with the model of just me. And there's a whole lot of we going on that has to be built into these systems. Like you said, it's not just charity. This has to do with, how we affect one another. And I don't feel like we have embraced we adequately to, prepare for those dangerous future crises that Phil talked about. I'm just curious what each of you, closing thoughts. We should tie it up here pretty soon, but what haven't we covered?
Oh, I think it's probably worth mentioning schools, because I think that's part of everyone's consideration.
Yes, yes.
I can't go back to work unless my kids are being cared for safely. And I know that there's a lot of parents thinking about that in the K-12 universe. I know there's a lot of concern about sending your children off to universities where, you know, you collect students from all over the world, some areas with very high prevalence. You kind of put them in a melting pot where they can give each other the virus, and then you send them home for break. It's a super collector and super spreader all in one. The worst of all pandemic worlds, really. So I think, it's probably worth discussing it. I think that there's a lot of press about studies that show there's not a lot of transmission in the universities. Similar to a lot of the press that says there's not a lot of transmission on the airplane. But I think the challenge with a lot of that is two things. One is that the agencies that are doing the reporting have a very conflicted interest that if they report honestly, they'll suffer extreme financial consequences. So that puts some of the reporting into question. But the other issue is, you know, beyond any nefarious kind of issues, it's just hard to attribute when someone was infected. And yeah, they might have flown on a plane, but if they also went to the hotel, you tell me where they got infected. It's very hard to distinguish. And so if you read the reports that are coming out of the airlines, what they're saying is they can't attribute any infections in the planes. What they're not saying is we are certain there were no infections on the planes. A very different statement. Mm-hmm. I think we have the same issue with the schools. And when we start to look at some of the state data and kind of start to tease apart, you know, what are the clues that tell us, when we made this change in local lockdowns and we allowed a restaurant to open or a gym to open or a school to open, you know, what was the effect on the exponential growth of the disease? And the truth is we can now see in a few states, not all of them, in a few states, it's very clear that the only change that they made in one period in October, you know, or September or January or August was to open the schools for in-person instruction. And, you know, within 5 days, you can see the growth go exponential. And so, you know, it's a little bit hard to tell if that's actually transmission within the schools or if there's some ancillary activities around the school, sports and social gathering, or it's, you know, the parents are relaxing because now that they're going to school, they figure they don't have to worry about other things. But in these cases, we can absolutely tie the exponential growth curve beginning to the starting of schools. So that tells us that we for those states where that trend is visible, they do not have sufficient abatement measures, sufficient testing, sufficient scanning and screening for symptoms, and sufficient ability to make sure that the virus does not get into the schools, even though something like 40% of the carriers have no symptoms to detect whatsoever unless you get a molecular lab test. So that is a very, very important message that I think needs to be much more broadly appreciated. And we have recommended testing regimens. We understand, you know, how long it takes for a student to become infected and then become infectious themselves. It's only about 2.5 to 3 days. So that means that if you're not testing your students at least twice a week, you're not catching all the cases that are coming into your school. Mm-hmm. So that's a very important message that I think needs to be much more widely distributed. And I think, we're going to suffer quite a lot of viral growth this fall because schools were pressed to open before they were ready to offer that level of safety measure.
Mm-hmm. So I'd like to, just add a way to think about exponentials in epidemics. So why are they exponential? It's not that the virus itself is exponential. The virus just has some rate at which it will infect somebody given contact. What's exponential is the connectivity between people. So for every person, they have their set of contacts at the first level. And the next set of people, they have their set of contacts. So that's a tree branching out for the contacts. And the communications flowing towards you up these trees. So it's exponential what's coming at you. So every time you add another person to your contact set, you've just incorporated the risk of that entire tree of contacts for each of those people. So that's really the way to think about, the problem of bringing people together. That's what happens with schools, as Phil said. You're bringing them together, and not only that, you're bringing them from different areas. So depending on the prevalence of the virus in those various areas, you're now going to equalize across other areas and pass it around. And that's what we're trying to break. With the social distance, we're trying to reduce the contact set, and with the mask, we're trying to reduce the rate at which the virus can be communicated to any contact that you do have with another human.
Tom, any final thoughts?
Yeah, well, I must say that in the last few months, I have greatly enjoyed my long-distance, socially distanced interactions with my colleagues. John was terrific in organizing the group, and Philip in organizing the investigation. I really am quite grateful to them both. I am myself, though, a bit disappointed, not in the people in the group, but with professional norms. I have to say that, I am always somewhat skeptical about professional norms in institutional contexts, but I think entirely too many journalists, doctors, social scientists have given way rather too much, too soon, too fast. The amount of political pressure that you can see exerted everywhere at all parts of the system, including the press reporting, it just makes me once again, I keep trying to tell myself I shouldn't be disappointed. I'm too old to be disappointed. But still, I am, and I deny having seen, as I occasionally used to do in classes, I deny living so long that I saw the sun hit the Great Pyramid or something like that. That's not what we're talking about. But the sort of the abdication of professional norms, it's just amazing to me that people who have plenty of cash and social positions and things would let political authorities muzzle them to the extent they did. That still astonishes me.
Yeah, well, I think that's in part why I'm grateful for this group, and I'm grateful that you're the research director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking, because we got to push through some of that resistance in order to, which you might call, invigorate the public good. And I see it as pervasive. I just made a series of videos with Daniel Ellsberg about nuclear winter and the way we're avoiding addressing what you might call the dangers that are in the offing there as well. So I think, go ahead, John.
Rob, just one more just point to build on this. So the public health problem, can be a public goods dilemma. So when the microeconomic actors or the micro political actors, if you will, are pursuing their own self-interest rather than the collective welfare, you have a problem. And the job of the state, of course, is to come in and address these public goods problems. And I think here in the 21st century, as we face competition with a centrally organized high mobilization command and control operation in China, the Western democracies are going to need smarter government. We're going to need to learn how to make government smarter so when these dilemmas come up, it's able to recognize them before the fact and to take a proactive action to manage them. And I think government has been afraid to intervene. I think there's been a whole sort of libertarian laissez-faire thread, which, you know, has a certain merit. But you still need the government to be capable and of recognizing these problems and being able to intervene and being able to mobilize the political will in order to, run these problems to ground. And we're seeing here, you know, a problem of mobilizing that political will and a lot of struggling and people trying to take local advantage at the expense of everyone else. Some people have suggested in these kinds of situations that when you have an actor who is busy lobbying against what needs to be done for the general will and will only make a small amount of money out of what they do versus, say, the $16 trillion that the rest of the country is going to have to pay, they should just be paid off to go away, right? Because that would be much cheaper than suffering the consequences. So I think that's another question maybe to contemplate in the lobbying area of, what kind of lobbying do you want to actually allow? Can you compromise the general welfare for your own special interest, especially in these kinds of serious national security issues? So when we, talked about, how important is this is public health? Do you have we're trying to preserve our democracy and our constitution. In order to do that, we need to be able to run our economy, at full performance. In order to be able to do that, we need to have, the public health security to allow that to happen. And we're also going to need the national security to provide the political integrity of the country and ability to pursue the above goals. So, in fact, pandemic response is a national security problem, and patriotism involves supporting your country in order to support your fellow citizens and your own well-being.
I couldn't agree more. I just have come from a 9-day conference of our Young Scholars Initiative called New Economic Questions. And at the request of our leadership at INET, we ask a number of people for what are the three most important questions. And in the spirit of open discourse, as a Scottish Presbyterian kid, I asked Pope Francis what his three questions were. And the first two were, if the origin of the word economy refers to the administration of household goods, one might ask, who today administers the goods of our common home? What bond unites those who administer those assets and those whose assets are administered? And his second question, which I was reminded of as I was preparing for this meeting, taking into account the administration of household goods requires its rules and its laws. What could be those laws that put the economy at the service of fragility? What should the relationship between economics and politics be like to ensure that everyone has what is necessary to live a fulfilling life? I think the spirit in which the three of you and the rest of the group are approaching this is very encouraging. And I think it is a very good example that I hope to continue to help you illuminate as we try to turn the corner. And as Philip has warned us, prepare for even more dangerous pandemics and propagating viruses in the future. But thank you all for being a part of this today. And I look forward to talking with you again, hopefully when people have adopted the kind of suggestions that you've made today and at least COVID-19 is behind us. For now, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Rob. Appreciate the opportunity to speak with you.
Yep, thanks.
We'll do so again.
Thanks, Rob.
Thank you.
Bye. And check out more from the Institute for New Economic Thinking at ineteconomics.org.
And I'll tell it and speak it and think it and breathe it. And reflect from the mountain so all souls can see it. And I'll stand on the ocean until I start sinking. But I'll know my song well before I start singing.